In this segment, we will talk about two forms of clinical decision support that are somewhat related, really mainly differed by how they're used and the acuity of by which they're used. But we will look at, in this segment, reminders and alerts. In the previous segments, we looked at some historical approaches to clinical decision support, and maybe we'll call these the modern approaches. What distinguishes them is that they take advantage of the context of the electronic health record. So reminders, again, remind clinicians to perform various actions. Alerts alert them in critical situations. CPOE, we will talk about in the next segment, and clinical practice guidelines will be discussed in a later unit. When we talk about clinical decision support, it's helpful to think of the different elements of it, and this taxonomy of clinical decision support was developed by Adam Wright, who was the first PhD graduate of the OHSU Biomedical Informatics Program, now at Partners Healthcare. This taxonomy has four components. These are triggers, which are things that cause rules to be invoked, such as an order being entered, a lab result being stored in the system, the patient being admitted to the hospital. There is input data, so this is data elements that are used by the rules, so the result of that lab that was just ordered or entered, any other kind of observation, the prescription of a drug, the establishment of a diagnosis, a patient's age, all of those are data elements. There are then interventions, which are possible actions that the clinical decision support system can take, and these have dimensions, so they may be urgent, things that need to be done right away, or non-urgent. We may wish to notify the user synchronously, that is to throw up a dialog box in front of them, or more asynchronously, perhaps through an email. So the various kinds of interventions are notifying the user, just putting the result into a log, showing some type of information, trying to obtain more data from a user. And then there are the specific choices that we offer to the user. So offering the user to write an order, allowing the user to defer action until later, allowing the user to override the advice of the system, or allowing the user to cancel or edit a particular order. Dr. Wright has also done some interesting work and writing about the evolution of clinical decision support systems. He identifies four phases that they have gone through. The first phase was the standalone systems, including those that we discussed in segment 4.1. This gave way to integrated systems where the decision support was integrated into electronic health records. This then further gave way to the development of standards-based systems, and he notes the Arden syntax, which we'll discuss later in this segment, and other standards. And finally, the latest phase is the service model based on service-oriented architecture, including the system that was developed in the work of his dissertation called SANS. He has also looked at evaluating commercial decision support systems to see how much of the desired features of such systems that they have, and a recently published evaluation of 9 leading systems showed that there is a broad diversity of desired features in different systems. So computer-based reminders are not a new idea, and as with diagnostic decision support, there is some older literature that represents some classic or seminal papers in the field. One of the early workers in this area was Clem McDonald, who has accomplished much over his illustrious career in informatics. He wrote a paper in the New England Journal in 1976 talking about the non-perfectibility of man, as was the term he used, as opposed to humans. But he did show that computer-based reminders showed some reduction in error in the process of delivering medical care. Octo Barnett, also an early worker in the field, showed that reminders for untreated streptococcal pharyngitis, also known as strep throat, led to increased use of treatment. And of course, the reason for doing that is that when untreated, strep throat can progress in a very small number of cases to acute rheumatic fever. Clem McDonald, in another study in 1984, showed that a paper printout of reminders, of course that's how they needed to be delivered back then, to order routine preventive care did result in increased utilization. But there were some other interesting findings from these studies. One is that when you removed the prompting, the behavior returned to baseline. So when you took away the reminders, the clinician would return to their previous lower level of ordering the right test or treatment. So it was deemed that these effects were not educational. They reminded busy physicians to do things that they ought to be doing. And here you see a figure from Octo Barnett's paper where the treatment of streptococcal pharyngitis was augmented with a reminder to the clinician, so the number of patients without treatment went from 10% down close to zero, and then the reminders were taken out of the system and the percent of people not treated went back up. In more recent time, reminders have also been shown to be beneficial. David Bates showed that they led to reduced ordering of redundant laboratory tests, so laboratory tests that were really not necessary. And when the clinician was reminded of this, the ordering of these tests was reduced. There was a systematic review of reminders in medication management, and it summarized all the literature up to that point and found a number of findings, such as leading to appropriate changes in classes of medications prescribed, increasing generic prescribing, improving activities related to medication management, so certain types of diagnostic testing that are done to monitor medication administration, enhancing patient adherence to medication regimen, and also studies showing that reminders that were prospective, so given at the time where the reminding needed to be done, were more effective than providing feedback in a retrospective manner later on. So in other words, throwing the reminder up on the screen as opposed to telling the physician later that he or she should have prescribed a drug differently was more effective to throw it up on the screen. There is some other research on reminders of note. One is that reminders were found to increase delivery of recommended care in patients with diabetes and coronary artery disease in one study. Another study, which is sometimes called the poster child for reminders because it had such a profound impact on a serious condition, was reminders for deep venous thrombosis prophylaxis. So that's giving anticoagulant or blood thinning medication to patients who are bedridden, usually after surgery. And of course, this puts them at risk for clots in the leg that can break off and cause pulmonary embolism, which can be quite serious, sometimes fatal. A reminder for DVT prophylaxis was found to reduce the actual rate of either DVT or pulmonary embolism by 41%. This study was published in New England Journal of Medicine, and one of the authors, way down on the list, was someone who happened to be an OHSU master's student at the time, Marilyn Paterno, who has now graduated from the program and is still working at Partners Healthcare where this study was done. Another study looked at factors associated with completion of reminders. So what factors were more likely to lead physicians to actually act on reminders? And it was found that incorporating clinical support staff, so making it easier for them, and providing them feedback was associated with completion of reminders, but there were no other characteristics of the clinician, such as age or gender or clinical experience or whatever, that led to completion of them. So let's talk about alerts. Alerts are usually used to detect and report adverse events. They're often used in the context of CPOE, which we'll talk about in the next segment, and they have been successfully used in many clinical situations. Things like nosocomial infections, so infections that develop in the hospital, adverse drug event, preventing injurious falls, and emerging diseases, or related things like bioterrorism, which we'll talk about more in Unit 6. So what is the rationale of providing alerts to clinicians? David Bates did an analysis of critical lab results in the 1990s, finding that appropriate response, usually a quicker response, might prevent 4.1% of adverse events, and another 5.5% might be prevented just by improved communication of the results. A study by Tate found that only 50% of life-threatening lab results were reported appropriately. This was in 1990. We've probably improved since then, but there are still many instances where serious lab results are not reported. Cooperman in 1998 found that in critical lab results, 27% of patients did not receive treatment for what was diagnosed by those lab results, usually an infection, within 5 hours. And Poon, asking physicians about reporting of test results, found that there was dissatisfaction with the ways that they were currently reported, with physicians expressing a desire for help with tracking the results all the way to completions, sending letters to patients, and just overall improving workflow efficiency. Alerts are usually generated by clinical event monitors. These are systems that detect events and suggest actions based on those events. Clinical event monitors allow integration of decision support within the electronic health record. What are the components of clinical event monitors? Well, there's basically three. There's the event, so something that triggers a rule to fire, so for example, a hemoglobin test being performed. There's then a condition which tests whether some sort of action should be performed, like is the hemoglobin value low enough so that the patient is critically anemic? And then if there's some action that needs to be taken, this is usually done in the form of informing the clinician through some sort of message. Now, of course, these are automated systems, so it's important that the data be of high quality. It needs to be recent data, and it must be valid. So, for example, as most clinicians know, sometimes a blood specimen will be hemolyzed, that is, the red blood cells will have been broken open in the process of drawing the blood, and that will elevate the potassium. So that can, of course, generate an alert, and the clinician must be able to find out quickly whether or not this specimen was found to be hemolyzed by the laboratory. So here's the clinical alerting system at Brigham and Women's Hospital. So there's an event monitor that knows about the patients, it knows the rules, and new data comes in that's evaluated by the event monitor. If some form of alert is required, this activates a notification program that, of course, because Brigham and Women's is a teaching hospital, has to determine which physician, in this case which house officer or resident, is covering a patient, activate the paging computer, informing the physician who has to log on to the computer and take action. So in the description of the Brigham and Women's event monitor, Cooperman also gave examples of some of the alerting criteria and how frequently they were fired. So the most common rule, making up almost 20% of all firing of rules, was when the hematocrit fell by 10% or more since the last result and is now less than 26. So that's the most commonly fired rule, at least in this analysis. Another rule related to hematocrit is that the value's fallen 6% or more since the previous result and has fallen faster than 0.4% per hour since the last result and is now less than 26% and the patient is not on the cardiac surgery service. So as you can see, these rules get pretty complicated. This one is basically a patient who's bleeding in a non-cardiac surgery situation. Another common rule relates to serum glucose, the value being greater than or equal to 400 milligrams per deciliter or elevated potassium. Now, of course, sometimes the physician doesn't respond to the alert, so at Brigham and Women's, they have a series of other steps to make sure that an important alert is communicated to a physician. So if the physician is paged and doesn't respond in 15 minutes, the border of the computer screen on the patient's floor turns red, which is then noted by the nurse, who then tries to contact the physician or take other action. If the alert's not acknowledged in 30 minutes, then a workstation in the telecommunications suite starts beeping so that the phone operator starts trying to get in touch with the floor with the physician. So how well did the alerting system function? Well, Cooperman looked at this as well, and comparing to situations where there was no automatic notification, it was noted that the alerting intervention resulted in a 38% shorter median time interval until appropriate treatment was ordered, 1.0 versus 1.6 hours. There was a shorter time until the alerting condition was resolved, 8.4 versus 8.9 hours, although at least in this study there was no difference of actual adverse events. A more recent study showed that alerts for multi-drug resistant bacteria in a hospital in France were found to increase the implementation of isolation precautions than when the alerts were not used. Now, there are a number of issues concerning alerts. So one is, how are they best delivered to the clinician? Do they set off a pager? Does someone make a phone call? Do we send an email? This really gets to one of the big problems with alerts, which is volume control, although it was now more frequently called alert fatigue, physicians complain of alert fatigue because they're alerted so many times in the EHR systems that they use. So we clearly want to communicate the most important alerts, but we don't want to overload the clinician, particularly with alerts that don't require immediate action. There are also a number of medical legal issues, such as what do we do about clinicians who don't respond to alerts? What do we do when alerts are not appropriately generated by the system and something's missed when we're depending on them? Another issue with alerts is how do we detect the alerting conditions? Obviously, it's easier to do with coded or numeric data, but it's more challenging when we're trying to rely on information in textual reports to alert us. And then how do we standardize alerts across different systems? And that brings us to the ARDEN syntax, which we'll talk about in the next slide. So the ARDEN syntax has been around for over a decade now. Again, it is a procedural language that allows delivery of what are called medical logic modules, or MLMs. These MLMs then allow sharing of decision support rules across different systems if decision support using ARDEN syntax is implemented by that system. ARDEN syntax specifies an event, a condition, and an action. We'll describe that more in the next slide. And it's now become a standard, ASTM E1460, and has also been recently converted to XML. So this is an example of ARDEN syntax. It looks like computer code, for those of you familiar with computer code. So the situation here is a penicillin order. That's the event. The prescriber has ordered a drug from the penicillin class, so it might be amoxicillin or methicillin. When that happens, that event then causes the system to look at this rule. It finds the patient allergies to see if there are any penicillin-related allergies, because as most clinicians know, any allergy to one penicillin means that there's an allergy to all of them. So the condition that the rule is looking for is whether there's a penicillin allergy. When that condition is met, an action is taken, and the message is sent that the patient has had this allergy to penicillin documented.